BBC World Service. Welcome to World Briefing. I'm Nicola Davis. The headlines at 9 hours Greenwich Mean Time. The Indian government has extended its ceasefire in Kashmir for another month and hinted at possible talks with Pakistan. The Taliban administration in Afghanistan has reacted angrily to the decision by the United Nations Security Council to impose new sanctions. The exiled leader of the rebel movement in the Indonesian province of Aceh has offered to restart talks with Indonesian officials on how to end the violence. Also in the programme, the final of the World Chess Championship is opening in Iran, where the game was banned after the Islamic Revolution. And two new studies by American scientists have concluded there is no link between the use of mobile telephones and brain cancer. This is the BBC in London. But before all that, we bring you a roundup of world news.
BBC News with Pauline Cavilla. The Indian government has extended its ceasefire in Kashmir by a month and says it's willing to consider talks with Pakistan on the future of the disputed region. The Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee made his announcements to Parliament.
The government is greatly heartened by the response of the citizens, political parties, and other organizations in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. Our peace initiative has been widely welcomed there. A distinctly different and a more optimistic mood now prevails in that state. There has also been a decline in the incidence of terrorist violence in that state. There has been a recognizable decline too in attempts at cross LOC and cross IV infiltration of terrorists. This must cease entirely.
The Taliban administration in Afghanistan has reacted angrily to tough new sanctions threatened by the United Nations Security Council. The sanctions, which include an arms embargo and the closure of Afghan Airlines offices, were proposed by the United States and Russia. Kate Clark reports from Kabul.
The Taliban Information Minister, Kudratullah Jamal, accused the UN of using Osama bin Laden as a pretext to attack the Taliban's Islamic system. He said the Taliban had tried to solve the dispute, for example suggesting that Mr. bin Laden be tried in an Islamic court, but he said the US had ignored these proposals. In Taliban eyes, the Saudi dissident is a guest and a veteran of the jihad, or holy war, against the Soviet occupation of the 1980s. Mr. Jamal said he would not be handed over. The sanctions would fail in their objective. Last year, when sanctions were first imposed on Afghanistan, there were angry protests and several UN offices were wrecked. But today, the streets of Kabul have been calm. The Taliban Information Minister said there would be no demonstrations.
Gun battles between riot police and demonstrators have raged throughout the night on the streets of Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic. Several protesters have been injured, though it's not yet known how seriously. The violence erupted at a banned opposition rally yesterday. One report says police fired live ammunition. At least 70 people have reportedly been arrested, four of them opposition MPs. The protesters were calling for the resignation of President Ange-Félix Patassé. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The exiled leader of the rebel Free Aceh movement has offered to restart talks with Indonesian officials on how to end the conflict in Aceh, which has claimed thousands of lives over the past decade. Hassan Datiro's offer follows a visit to Aceh by President Wahid. Jonathan Head reports from Aceh.
The unexpected offer of renewed talks by Hassan Datiro gives a glimmer of hope to a peace process which has barely got off the ground, but is little more than that. Although widely respected in Aceh for his role in founding the Free Aceh movement in the 1970s, Hassan Datiro is an elderly and unpredictable leader who lives in exile in Sweden. It isn't clear exactly what he wants to discuss with the Indonesian side. Representatives of the rebel movement inside Aceh have not been consulted about the talks. The positions of both sides still appear irreconcilable. The Free Aceh movement will not consider anything less than full independence from Indonesia, a stand that enjoys wide popular support. The central government will go no further than offering substantial autonomy. After years of atrocities at the hands of the Indonesian army, few Acehese are ready to trust any offer from Jakarta.
The security forces in Turkey have made another attempt to gain control of one of the prisons still holding out after their mass raids on Tuesday. They launched a pre-dawn raid on the Imrania prison in Istanbul as prisoners continued their protests against plans to transfer to other jails with fewer people per cell. The Anatolia news agency said armoured cars, a bulldozer and a fire engine were used. Yesterday, at least 17 prisoners and two soldiers died. The final of the World Chess Championship is due to begin shortly in the Iranian capital, Tehran. At stake is not only the title, but $3.5 million in prize money. The finalists are Viswanathan Anand from India and Alexei Shirov, an ethnic Russian who now lives in Spain. Negotiators from the world of football are to meet officials from the European Commission in Brussels later today to try to reach agreement on the future of the transfer system. The Commission says the present system, where clubs buy players from other clubs, breaks European law on fair competition and workers' rights of freedom of movement. It'll be the third time in a month they've tackled the subject. BBC News.
It's 9:06 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Nicola Davis. The first ceasefire India has called in Kashmir since a Muslim insurgency began there in 1989 will be extended by another month. The Indian Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, said the decision had been taken because of a noticeable decline in activity by separatist militants. Our South Asia correspondent Mike Woodridge reports from Delhi.
The ceasefire, or no initiation of combat operations, as the government defines it, was declared in November for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Mr. Vajpayee gave Parliament a relatively upbeat assessment of its impact to justify its extension for a further month. He said there'd been a reduction in what he called incidents of terrorist violence in Kashmir, though some hardline militant groups had continued with their activities, leading to innocent civilian lives being lost and security force personnel being killed. Along the line of control, the line dividing India and Pakistan in Kashmir, Mr. Vajpayee said there'd been a recognisable decline in infiltration by militants and fewer exchanges of fire between the forces of the two countries. Overall, he said, there was now a more optimistic mood in Kashmir and the constituency for peace had been expanded. Talks between India and Pakistan broke down with a near war between them in Kashmir last year. Mr. Vajpayee held out the prospect that they could start again and said the government would initiate exploratory steps, though he said this would require a suitable environment. The specific emphasis of the past on Pakistan stopping what India calls cross-border terrorism was missing. But there can be little doubt that India will weigh up the prospects for new talks in the light of how events continue to turn out in Kashmir.
Mike Aldridge in Delhi. Efforts by the United States and Russia to step up sanctions against the Taliban administration in Afghanistan have prevailed, despite pleas to the contrary by the United Nations leadership. The UN Security Council has imposed tough new measures, including an arms embargo. Washington and Moscow accuse the Taliban of supporting international terrorism. They're especially annoyed at the Taliban's refusal to hand over the Saudi-born Islamic militant Osama bin Laden. The Security Council resolution gives the Taliban 1 month to hand over Osama bin Laden for trial in connection with the bombings that killed 224 people at two US embassies in East Africa in 1989. In 1998, the Taliban representative to the UN, Abdul Hakim Mujahid, has denounced the move, saying the sanctions will violate human rights in Afghanistan.
These kind of sanctions, they are, I think, the brutal ones against the Charter of the United Nations, against the spirit of the Organization of the United Nations. The United Nations organization want to keep peace and security in the world and protect human rights all over the world. But these kind of sanctions will violate human rights there in Afghanistan and will deteriorate peace and security in the country.
The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has warned that the sanctions would not improve the situation in Afghanistan, but would be implemented nevertheless.
It is not going to facilitate our peace efforts, nor is it going to facilitate our humanitarian work. I think we had given adequate indications of that to the Council, but the decision belongs to the Council, and of course, once they take the decision, we have to adapt and take the necessary measures that are required.
Anticipating the new sanctions, most international aid agencies have already withdrawn their foreign staff from Afghanistan for fear that they'd become targets for reprisals. The president-elect of the United States, George W. Bush, is expected to name further members of his cabinet later today. He's already named several leading officials, including the former Gulf War commander, retired General Colin Powell, as his Secretary of State. Mr. Bush is back in his hometown of Austin in Texas State after meetings in Washington yesterday with President Clinton and his former presidential contender, Al Gore. Rob Watson reports from Washington.
Having introduced himself to official Washington, George W. Bush is now planning to introduce more cabinet members to the country and the world. Among the expected announcements, his old friend and campaign chairman, Don Evans, for Commerce Secretary, and former Republican Senator Dan Coats for Secretary of Defense. As yet, though, no names of potential Democrats prepared to cross the aisles to serve in a Bush administration. But the president-elect's political and racial outreach program is set to continue. In Austin later today, meetings with black ministers who favor Mr. Bush's ideas of greater involvement by religious groups in solving the country's social problems. Before leaving Washington, D.C., George W. Bush visited the man he defeated, Vice President Al Gore. Though the visit was short, it was the symbolism that mattered, the two men shaking hands and patting each other on the back, all in full view of the television cameras and the watching American public. During his 2 days in Washington, the buzzword was bipartisanship from Mr. Bush and the Democrats alike. But when Mr. Bush returns here as president for real, the talking is expected to be tougher on both sides.
Rob Watson in Washington. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have begun talks in the United States on reviving the Middle East peace process after 3 months of violence. The U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Dennis Ross, held separate meetings with the two sides at a secluded airbase in Washington.
I think that both sides do have a new sense of urgency. I think the last 10 weeks have also highlighted for each side what the alternative is. I think from our standpoint, what we're trying to do is stabilize the situation and transform the situation from the standpoint of peacemaking, and we'll see what's possible.
If the talks go well, there is a chance direct negotiations could begin. But one issue that has troubled the Israeli government, how to deal with the uprising of the Palestinian people, the Intifada, will not go away quickly. The head of the Fatah militia in the West Bank, Marwan Barghouti, has said he won't call off the Intifada, even if Yasser Arafat wants him to. The uprising has already cost more than 300 lives. Mike Donkin sent this report from the West Bank town of Ramallah, which has seen perhaps the worst of the bloodshed.
This is the front line for the Intifada. And it's getting deadlier as stone throwers have given way to snipers on the Palestinian side and the Israelis have traded machine gun fire and tank shells. But the commander of Yasser Arafat's Fatah militia on the West Bank, Marwan Barghouti, claims this is not an uprising orchestrated from the top.
Of course, there are general lines, and we have the leadership of the Intifada. We sit down together, we discuss what kind of activities we will have. But on the ground, sometimes the people are coming with a huge number, sometimes they are coming very little. The Intifada represents the will of the people.
I was taken to a deserted building where Fatah has now started training the many keen recruits to the cause in Ramallah.
البندقية كلاشينكوف. شو اسم السلاح؟ كلاشينكوف.
An instructor showed how to load an automatic weapon and the best positions to fire it from. More weapons and magazines were stacked against the wall. But the quartermaster was adamant this was more of a home guard than an assault force.
We could not stand by in front of a modern army like Israeli. So what we are trying, if they trying to attack someone inside his village, inside his city, he should protect himself.
Each of the 80-odd recruits stepped forward as his number was called. Their faces were masked by black balaclavas.
We know each other by number, you know, and when we come to this place, we hide our faces. When we leave, we just uncover, and that's it.
Ahmed seemed one of the oldest there. Most looked to be in their late teens. But all, he said, had the same motive.
I have two children. I have to defend them. That's why I joined here. It's not a matter of students or people underage. We have 55 years old people trained here. We have to defend our families.
The uprising has taken a deadly toll in Ramallah. 30 Palestinians have died already. I went to the home of one family in mourning. Saha has lost a son and a young nephew, but it's a price she's reluctantly prepared to pay.
I have 9 more sons, and I'm willing to sacrifice them all. If I say that I don't want to sacrifice anymore, and another family says that they don't want to sacrifice anymore, how are we going to get our independent state and get our rights?
Israel would say that the Palestinians could relieve their suffering by putting aside their weapons now, and has called on their leaders to order that.
Mike Donkin in Ramallah. The United Nations has accused Liberia of systematically breaking weapons and diamonds embargoes against Sierra Leone and so fueling its civil war. In a draft summary seen by journalists, a panel of experts says money from diamonds smuggled out of Sierra Leone through Liberia is going straight into the pockets of the rebel Revolutionary United Front, which uses it to buy arms and fuel. The UN team wants a ban on diamond exports from Liberia and calls on Western countries to clarify exactly where the diamonds they import come from. The trial gets underway today of 10 people accused of taking part in the killings 2 years ago of the Berber singer Lounès Mahtoub. 8 of them are being tried in their absence. The killing prompted bloody riots in the Kabylie region of eastern Algeria, where Lounès Mahtoub was seen as a folk hero of the Berber ethnic group. He was an opponent of Islamic fundamentalism as well as of the Arab authorities in Algiers. His killing has been widely blamed on the GIA, or Armed Islamic Group, which kidnapped him for 2 weeks in 1994. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news: the Indian Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, has extended the government's ceasefire in Kashmir by another month, saying that there has been a decline in activity by separatist militants. The Taliban administration in Afghanistan has reacted angrily to the decision by the United Nations Security Council to impose new sanctions. And two separate studies in the United States have found no link between mobile telephones and brain cancer. Both studies examined whether people who had brain cancer used mobile phones more than people who didn't. Neither found any difference. One survey was released several weeks ago by the National Cancer Institute. The other has just been published. Toby Murcutt of our science staff has been looking at the latter survey.
Mobile phones emit microwave radiation, and these emissions are highest when they're carrying a call, which is, of course, the time when a mobile phone is pressed to the user's ear. As a result, there's been considerable concern over whether this radiation might be harmful, and in particular, cause cancer. This new study, conducted by researchers at the American Health Foundation in the United States, has attempted to address some of these fears by comparing mobile phone use in people who have brain cancer with healthy volunteers. In all, nearly 900 people were interviewed at hospitals around the United States, half of whom had one of two types of brain cancer. The researchers found that there was no correlation between mobile phone use and the development of brain cancer in the study group. However, this doesn't rule out the possibility that slower growing tumours might appear in the future, or that mobile phone radiation causes any other form of damage. Last year, researchers in England demonstrated that people exposed to such emissions recorded slightly faster reaction times in tests and found no evidence that mobile phone use was harmful. This latest research doesn't mean that mobiles are safe and is unlikely to change the British government's advice that, as a precaution, children should only use mobile phones in emergencies.
Toby Murcutt of our science staff. The Chinese President Jiang Zemin has called on the leadership in Macau to protect the national interest of China against activists who sought to challenge the government in Beijing. Mr. Jiang was speaking in Macau on the first anniversary of the return of the former Portuguese colony to Chinese rule. He said Beijing would not intervene in the province's daily affairs, but warned that the local authorities should not allow any activity that threatened the authority of China. He said the same applied to neighbouring Hong Kong. Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Beijing reports.
The Chinese leader's words will be of little comfort to those who believe freedom of expression in Macau and Hong Kong is under threat from Beijing. When China regained sovereignty over Macau a year ago, it promised not to interfere in the way the former Portuguese enclave is run. President Jiang insisted that is still the case. But at the same time, he said authorities in Macau should never allow anyone to stage activities there that are against the central government in Beijing or that try to split the country. He added that what applies to Macau also applies to Hong Kong. Authorities in Macau have already been criticized for rounding up human rights activists and members of the Falun Gong spiritual movement ahead of President Jiang's visit. Falun Gong is banned in China, but is legal in Macau. Nevertheless, Macau police arrested close to 40 members of the group and prevented others from entering the enclave from Hong Kong. President Jiang also took a swipe at Macau's media, saying it should play a more positive role in matters bearing on Macau's prosperity and the interests of the state.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Beijing. Today is the last day of campaigning in Serbia before the general election on Saturday. The people have seen a rapid political change since the downfall of Slobodan Milosevic in October, but there's still much to do on the economic front. With the onslaught of a cold European winter, the immediate challenge is to provide the most basic needs for survival. Aid agencies have provided emergency assistance, while the European Union and United States have promised aid packages. Serbia is paying the price of years of economic mismanagement, as our correspondent Jackie Rowland has been finding out.
The streets of Belgrade have become one big flea market. Grinding poverty has driven ordinary people to sell off their personal possessions. Hats, shoes, a table lamp are spread out on the ground. Under 10 years of rule by Slobodan Milosevic, they've been trying to get by on wages that are worth less every month. The average salary now is just $40. Many people have reached breaking point. Aid agencies are now feeding tens of thousands of people every month through a network of soup kitchens. The state is bankrupt, so international donors have stepped in to fill the gap. The European Union Commissioner for Humanitarian Affairs, Paul Nielsen, admits there's a danger of Serbia becoming dependent on aid. But he says the international community has no alternative.
You are right, I think, in describing the risk and, in certain cases, the reality of dependency. But that, I mean, if we stop as soon as we see a trace of dependency and run away scared of the proportion of the problem, we're not living up to our responsibility.
A crane loads coal onto a truck down near the docks in Belgrade. Part of the task facing the international community is to make sure that people don't freeze this winter. The aid agency Oxfam is providing thousands of tons of coal as part of the emergency response to the crisis in Serbia. The truck empties its load outside a house where a refugee family is living. They're lucky it's been a mild winter so far. They may be able to sell some of the coal to buy food. This is the reality of life in Serbia today. Slobodanka Torbica of Oxfam says people find a way to survive even if they don't receive a regular income.
There's no understanding for the struggle of the local population who have no employment, who have no income, the failure of the state structure, and it's simply impossible to get by. Forget about meat on your menu, forget about fruit on your menu, forget about everything.
That report on life in Serbia was by our correspondent in Belgrade, Jackie Rowland. Two of Russia's top intelligence officers have made rare public comments on the danger of foreign agents. In a newspaper interview, the director of the National Security Service, Nikolai Patrushev, said the secret services of leading NATO countries had intensified their operations in Russia. His colleague in the Foreign Intelligence Agency, Sergei Lebedev, said despite threats of spying from the West, they still had to cooperate to fight against terrorism, drug trafficking, and the spread of nuclear weapons. The authorities in Mexico have put the emergency authorities on special alert around the erupting volcano Popocatépetl. It's been spewing out molten rock and ash for the past few days, and scientists have warned of a dangerous buildup of pressure inside the volcano's crater. Now there's a fear the melting ice on top of the volcano may cause a massive mudslide. Popocatépetl lies just 60 kilometres from Mexico City, from where our correspondent Peter Gresta reports.
As if the emergency services in Mexico didn't have enough to worry about. First, a major volcanic eruption threatening tens of thousands of homes just outside one of the world's biggest cities. Now, the real threat of a mudslide, ironically caused by a huge chunk of ice at the top of the volcano. The ice is a permanent feature of the 5,500-meter peak, but with the constant showering of red-hot rock, there is now the danger that one particularly big chunk could break loose. The Interior Minister, Santiago Creel, who's coordinating the emergency effort, said the authorities are on maximum alert. We have to be ready for any possible contingency regarding the ice, he said. In the meantime, they've got their hands full helping the 30,000 people now sheltering in emergency centres. The army has mobilised troops to feed the masses, and it's organised patrols into danger zones to keep watch over the vacant properties and to keep looters away. The difficulty for the government is knowing how long this crisis may continue. Santiago Creel has warned that if the volcano carries on with its sporadic explosions of rock and ash, as many as 48,000 people may need food and shelter.
Peter Gresta in Mexico City. Bolivia says its armed forces are on the verge of completing a controversial program to eradicate all illegal coca plantations. At a ceremony in the southern Chapare region, President Hugo Banzer said the 21st century would see a Bolivia free of coca. Nearby, several thousand coca leaf farmers gathered to voice their opposition. Since taking office 3 years ago, Mr. Banzer has overseen a program supported by the United States, which has wiped out almost 50,000 hectares of coca leaves, the base ingredient for cocaine. During the last year, there have been a number of violent confrontations between security forces and coca leaf farmers, who say they're being offered no incentive to switch to alternative crops. And chess fans around the world will be excited to know that the International Chess Federation's World Championships get underway shortly in the Iranian capital, Tehran. After a challenging series of eliminations in Delhi, the contest is down to just two men, the Indian Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand and the Latvian-born ethnic Russian Alexei Shirov, who now plays for Spain. There's $3.5 million prize money at stake. Well, our chess fan in Tehran is Jim Muir.
Some hardline Iranian clerics still frown on chess. They see it as a form of gambling, and the regal aspect of hunting the king also strikes the wrong note for them. The game was banned in public after the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but less than 10 years later, Ayatollah Khomeini himself issued a fatwa saying it was all right. Now chess is back out in the open here, with the National Federation to promote its interests. Officials say there are more than 100,000 active players around the country, some of them as fanatical and obsessed with the game as people anywhere else in the world. It's quite common to see quiet struggles going on in parks and cafes, as well as indoors. Many of the Iranian players are very young. Iran has a huge new generation of young people who are embracing the game with enthusiasm. It's already produced several young world beaters, including the reigning champion in the girls' under-12 category, Atousa Pourkashi. But chess itself is hardly new to Iran. It's widely believed that the game originated here 2,000 years ago. Historians say there's textual evidence, as well as the fact that many chess terms, such as checkmate, are believed to come from Farsi.
Jim Muir in Tehran. And now a brief reminder of today's main world news. The Indian government has extended its ceasefire in Kashmir by a month and says it's willing to consider talks with Pakistan on the future of the disputed region. The Indian Prime Minister, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, told Parliament that although violence in Kashmir had not ended, it had fallen off. I'm Nicola Davis. You're listening to the BBC in London.
World of dramatic developments. NewsHour brings you the stories that matter.
Late night Belgrade and the elite intervention unit of the Serbian police speeds to a bank robbery. Hurry, hurry. One intruder is still inside.
I've not met a single Achenese yet who is remotely interested in this visit. I think President Wahid lost huge amounts of credibility by offering a referendum early in his administration and then abandoning that idea.
It's going to be the world's most modern aircraft. It's going to be the most efficient in terms of the seat mile costs, in other words, fuel usage. It will have the latest technology on it, so emissions, noise, everything like that will be absolutely state-of-the-art.
Wherever you are in the world, NewsHour makes sense of what's going on.
BBC World Service, you're listening to World Briefing. I'm Nicola Davis. Well, stay tuned because coming up in the next half hour, sport with news that Ipswich and Crystal Palace are through to the semi-finals of English Football's League Cup. And an analysis, we have a report on the impact of an American immigration policy that's led to thousands of criminals being deported from the United States. That's in 15 minutes. But first, here's a summary of the latest world news with Pauline Cavilla.
The Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee has extended the government's ceasefire in Kashmir by another month. He told Parliament in Delhi that there had been a decline in activity by separatist militants and fewer exchanges of fire with Pakistani forces. The Taliban administration in Afghanistan has reacted angrily to tough new sanctions proposed by the United Nations Security Council. The sanctions include an arms embargo and the closure of Afghan Airlines offices. A Taliban spokesman accused the UN of being an enemy of Islam. The exiled leader of the Achenese rebels in northern Indonesia has offered to restart talks with the government on how to end years of separatist violence. He suggested talks could take place in Switzerland as early as next week. Gun battles between riot police and demonstrators have raged throughout the night on the streets of Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic. Several protesters have been injured, though it's not yet known how seriously. The violence erupted at a banned opposition rally yesterday. The security forces in Turkey have made another attempt to gain control of one of the prisons still holding out after their mass raids on Tuesday. They launched a pre-dawn raid on the Emaniye prison in Istanbul as prisoners continued their protests against plans to transfer to other jails with fewer people per cell. There's continuing concern over the danger from the Popocatépetl volcano near Mexico City, which has spewed molten rock and ash into the air following several explosions. Experts now fear a lava flow could melt the ice and snow cap around the volcano and trigger deadly mudslides. Iran is hosting the final of the World Chess Championship, which is due to begin shortly in the capital, Tehran. The finalists are from India and an ethnic Russian now living in Spain. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, and now sport. And English football's League Cup is now down to the final four teams. Ipswich and Crystal Palace are the latest teams through to the semis. With the details and the rest of the sport, here's Pam Dixon.
Thanks, Nicola. Coming up in this roundup of world sport, Japan and Korea's footballers are getting ready for the Battle of the World Cup hosts, and we'll be looking back at the year in golf. But first, Crystal Palace and Ipswich are through to the semi-finals of English Football's League Cup. Palace beat Sunderland 2-1 in a rescheduled match at Selhurst Park. John Murray was there.
Peter Reid didn't pick his strongest team. Quinn, McCann and Craddock were rested from the starting lineup. But on paper, Sunderland was still streets ahead of Crystal Palace, full of internationals and experience. Yet they were outplayed by Palace, who were full of confidence after going 12 matches unbeaten now. Forsell and Morrison looked dangerous together up front and scored the goals. Ray had equalised for Sunderland. And for manager Alan Smith, after an extraordinary 20 weeks back at Palace full of ups and downs, just like the last time he was in charge at Selhurst Park, he has a League Cup semi-final against Liverpool to look forward to, and now his Palace team should not be underestimated.
Ipswich came from behind to win 2-1 at Manchester City. Mark Venus scored the winner in extra time. Ipswich played Birmingham in the semis, and as you heard there, Crystal Palace are up against Liverpool. Five more teams are through to the third round of the FA Cup. Luton, Peterborough, York, Wickham and Notts County won their second round replays on Tuesday. Football's world governing body FIFA have commended Paolo Di Canio for his sportsmanship. The West Ham striker was in a position to score against Everton on Saturday, but he caught the ball and stopped play because Everton's goalkeeper was down injured. FIFA's spokesman is Keith Cooper.
Let's get things into perspective. The game is a game and it needs more than anything else
people to play to the rules and to play to the spirit of the rules, and this spirit has been going out of the game. We know that it's professional, but the guys at the top end of the game in the professional sport, they've got to send role model signals and signs further down the level to the grassroots, and particularly to young people. We see enough examples of bad sportsmanship, so on those rare occasions when we get something brilliant and shining like this, then we have to play it up. We have to make the most of it and applaud it, because it is, after all, just a game.
The Moroccan international Hassan Kahloul has been charged with misconduct by the English Football Association after his sending off against Leeds earlier this month. The Southampton player has been charged with violent and threatening behaviour after appearing to aim a headbutt at Leeds midfielder Lee Boyer. Real Madrid have moved to the top of the table in Spain. They beat Rayo Vallecano 3-1 at home. Luis Figo followed up his European Player of the Year award by scoring Real's opening goal. His side are now 1 point clear of Valencia, but Valencia can regain top spot if they win at Athletic Bilbao later on today. The co-hosts of the 2002 World Cup finals, Japan and South Korea, are getting ready to play a friendly in Tokyo. Although friendly isn't necessarily the word to describe the history between the two countries. Jeremy Walker is from Japan's daily Yomiuri newspaper.
Japan colonised Korea for the Korean Peninsula from 1910 right through until 1945. So, you know, the Korean people always feel they have something to prove. And, you know, they really do, they do treat this game as much more serious, much more meaningful in the overall scheme of things than just a football game. I was reading Maradona this week saying that, you know, the way they avenged the Falkland Islands was by beating England in 86. And this is the way the Koreans feel here, you know, that any time they can beat Japan, it's getting one back for what happened in things obviously not connected with the game at all. So it's a very, very intense rivalry, especially from the Korean side.
For the third time in its three-year history, South America's Copa Mercosur has produced an all-Brazilian final. And with one win each for Palmeiras and Vasco da Gama, a third game is needed to break the deadlock. Tim Vickery reports.
Winners 2 years ago and runners-up last season, Palmeiras are the Mercosur specialists. Luck of the draw has given them home advantage in this decisive match, and for the first time in the series, they're set to be at full strength. Back from suspension is right-back Arce, a magnificent crosser of the ball, and recovered from injuries, centre-forward Tuta, a frequent threat in the air. It's a combination that concerns Vasco, who will have to decide which of their vastly experienced centre-backs will counter the threat. Partnering Ojivan at the heart of the defence will be either Junior Baiano or Mauro Galvão, who was 39 on the eve of the game. The man who will take the decision is not Osvaldo de Oliveira, who's coached Vasco with such success this season. He was sacked in the dressing room after Saturday's 2-2 draw with Cruzeiro in the Brazilian Championship semi-final first leg. Oliveira fell out with controversial Vasco director Urico Miranda, whose truculent nature was not calmed by the news last week that he's to be investigated by the anti-corruption inquiry currently being conducted in Congress. Coach and director fell out over whether the team should train on Monday morning or afternoon. Miranda also criticised Oliveira's gesture of embracing the Cruzeiro coach at the end of the game. So, at Romario's recommendation, in comes coach Joel Santana for this dramatic week for Vasco. On Saturday, they fight for a place in the final of the Brazilian Championship. But before that, the destiny of the Copa Mercosul is at stake.
Cricket now, and Australia have named their 14-man squad for the fourth test against West Indies, which starts in Melbourne on Tuesday. Their captain, Steve Waugh, is back from injury, and so is their fast bowler, Brett Lee, which could mean there's no place for two of the heroes of the third test, batsman Damian Martin and spinner Colin Miller. But Steve Waugh says he'll need a fitness test before the match starts, and he still isn't sure if Brett Lee has recovered from his back problems.
Really only if you're guided by the scans that he'll get in a couple of days' time. I mean, but this test match he probably could have played, he would have felt okay, but the signs are there that there is something serious, so he's got to get that monitored. If it's clear, he'll play, but if there's still signs of it being there, he won't play, so no one really knows the answer to that.
Sri Lanka have beaten KwaZulu-Natal by 55 runs in a one-day match in Durban in South Africa. Batting first, the visitors made 266 for 8 from their 50 overs. Mahela Jayawardena top-scored with 86. In reply, Natal were restricted to 211 all out. The host New Zealand are through to the final of the Women's World Cup. They beat India by 9 wickets in the second semi-final. The Kiwis meet Australia in the final on Saturday. The former boxer Michael Watson has won the final stage of his battle for compensation. Watson suffered brain damage during a world title fight 9 years ago, and now the British Boxing Board of Control has lost its High Court appeal against liability for Watson's injuries. Gordon Farker reports.
In a statement, the BBBC said it noted the judge's decision and insisted that its sympathies had always been with Michael Watson. The Court of Appeal upheld the earlier verdict that the board owed Watson a duty of care and had been negligent in failing to introduce regulations to prevent the seriousness of the type of injuries suffered by Michael Watson after losing his fight against Chris Eubank at White Hart Lane 9 years ago. Watson came into court in a wheelchair to hear the verdict. He'll need professional care for the rest of his life. The British Boxing Board of Control went into financial administration last year and had previously claimed that a punitive finding could push it into bankruptcy. A spokesman for the administrators said that creditors would be consulted and he expected Watson would be made an offer within the next 2 months.
The British boxer Paul Ingall has undergone throat surgery to ease the pressure on his chest. He remains seriously ill but stable in a Sheffield hospital. Earlier in the week, the former world featherweight champion had an emergency operation to remove a blood clot on the brain following Saturday's defeat by South Africa's Mbulela Botile. The disciplinary hearing for the South African rugby union player Cobus Visashi has been adjourned until January. It follows claims that the banned steroid revealed in a drugs test on the prop was given to him by the South African Rugby Football Union. With more details from South Africa, here's Craig Ray.
Visashi's defence argued that one of the supplements supplied to the players by the union contained an illegal substance, and that is what showed in his routine drug test. The hearing, which has been chaired by Judge Edwin King, the man at the helm of investigations into corruption and match fixing in South African cricket, has been adjourned until the end of January so that the judge can concentrate on cricket matters. Visashi claims that the drug was given to him at the Stellenbosch University, one of South Africa's leading rugby breeding grounds. The evidence caught the prosecution team by surprise, forcing them to admit to no previous knowledge of that and that they would have to investigate the matter on their own. Visashi's hearing has lasted for over 2 weeks with 4 days of actual evidence being presented. If he is found guilty, he will face a ban of at least 2 years. The 27-year-old player has maintained his innocence throughout the investigation.
The Swiss cycling authorities will decide next week what action should be taken against Richard Vironck after he confessed to doping offences at the Festina trial at Lille in France in October. Well, it's time now to continue our series of reviews of the sporting year, and today it's the turn of golf, which, as Russell Fuller reports, was dominated by one man.
This is for his first US Open title. It's hush around the 18th. He taps it forward, and in it goes, and there is the big smile and the clenched fist, and Tiger Woods becomes US Open champion.
Woods putts and holds it and punches the air. And Tiger Woods is the Open champion for the year 2000. He's completed the Grand Slam of the sport's four major titles.
Tiger Woods has beaten Bob May by one shot in a three-hole playoff, winning his third successive major, his fourth in five majors.
Tiger Woods just gets better and better, and it's becoming increasingly hard to find adjectives that do justice to his unique talents. He chose two of the most famous courses in the world to illustrate his total dominance over his supremely talented peers, who look ordinary and error-prone in his company. At Pebble Beach in California in June, he won the US Open by 15 shots, and then, 5 weeks later, destroyed virtually the same field to win the Open Championship at St Andrews by 8 and complete his set of golf's four major titles. His playoff victory over a gutsy Bob May in the US PGA Championship in August enthralled us all, but the result was the same, and it meant that Tiger Woods had become the first man since Ben Hogan in 1953 to win three majors in one season. The 24-year-old, who was voted the most powerful man in sport by America's Sporting News magazine, won 10 of the 22 official events he entered and has trebled his lead at the top of the world rankings.
It was such a fantastic year to have an opportunity to complete the Grand Slam on probably two of the most famous venues there is in golf, Pebble Beach as well as St. Andrews. So I was very fortunate, and it was a very historic year for me, and it was, more importantly, I think it was a very special year. I love to compete, and I think that is the basis for everything that I do in this game, is that I try and get myself ready. I try and be the best I possibly can be, you know, each and every time I play in a tournament, because I love to compete, and to be able to go down a stretch in a tournament with a chance to win is what it's all about.
Vijay Singh deserves a mention for winning the Masters at an unseasonably cold Augusta in April. Ernie Els finished second in three of the season's four majors. And Lee Westwood ended Colin Montgomery's seven-year spell at the top of the European Order of Merit. But the year 2000 was the year of the Tiger, and if Woods wins the Masters next April, he'll become the first man to have had all four major titles in his possession at one time. He's won it before, don't forget, in 1997 by a record margin of 12.
Russell Fuller looking back on the year in golf. A quick reminder of the main story now. The semi-final lineups complete for football's Worthington League Cup. Ipswich Town play Birmingham City, while Crystal Palace take on Liverpool. That's all from this roundup of World Sport. Nicola.
Thanks, Pam. That was Pam Dixon. It's 9:45 Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now, a reminder of the latest world news. The Indian government has extended its ceasefire in Kashmir for another month and hinted at possible talks with Pakistan. The Taliban administration in Afghanistan has reacted angrily to the decision by the United Nations Security Council to impose new sanctions. And the final of the World Chess Championship is opening in Iran, where the game was banned after the Islamic Revolution. This is the BBC in London. Now it's time for analysis. As part of its war on drugs and crime, the United States deports hundreds of thousands of so-called criminal aliens, non-American citizens who have committed crimes in the states. All of them have served their sentences in prison before being sent back to homelands that some have not seen since childhood. Many are sent back to Latin America and the Caribbean. In this edition of Analysis, Andy Kershaw reports from Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, where the hardline US immigration policy is having a dramatic impact.
This is the vast slum of Cité Soleil in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Cité Soleil is home, of sorts, to 300,000 people, and they live in the filth which flows down here to the waterfront from the wealthier suburbs. I'm on my way to meet someone who never, in his worst nightmares, expected to live in a place like this. Augustin Salville left Haiti with his parents to live in the United States when he was a small boy. Age 17, he was convicted for selling $100 worth of cocaine. He served 3.5 years in jail, where he dreamed of getting a job in Burger King. When he did get out a couple of years ago, he was flown straight back to Haiti, a land he barely knew. He's homesick, and unashamedly misses his comfortable home and his mother back in Massachusetts.
I wasn't trying to be a bad boy out there. I wasn't trying to be the biggest drug dealer. I was trying to make money just to look good, to buy nice clothes, nice little rings, nice little stuff. I was trying to be a pretty boy. Justin 17. They should have given me another chance. I asked for another chance. They didn't give it to me.
If life's tough for Augustin, it's far worse for the newly arrived deportees because the Haitian government can't cope with them. Last year, it told the United States that it couldn't take any more. A backlog of 500 deportees built up. Since June, they've been taken straight off aeroplanes and locked up in prisons and police cells across the country, often crammed in alongside disturbed and violent criminals. I'm going to try and get into one such police station in the dusty little town of Quadabaque, just north of the capital. It's like a scene from the Middle Ages in there. There are a couple of cages, cells facing each other, with iron bars on the doors. And the thing that shocked me most is the windowless. Inside, it's completely dark. And all the, at first, until my eyes adjusted, all I could see were these kind of little pools of light, which turned out to be lots and lots of eyeballs. And it was stiflingly hot, and it stank. He wouldn't let me talk to the prisoners at Quadabaque, so I've turned up at the cells of the anti-gang unit at police headquarters in the centre of Port-au-Prince, once the notorious HQ of Papadoc's secret police. It's a new, retrained police force these days, but inside there is a scene of time-honoured Haitian chaos. Among the deportees banged up here is 26-year-old Ernest Rampenau Jr. from Brooklyn. Like Augustin, he was also convicted of a drugs charge and served 8 years in an American prison before being sent back to Haiti, where he's not lived since he was a child. His parents, wife and daughter are all in the United States.
They told us we was going to be locked up for like a day until they do paperwork. Yeah. That's what they told us in the plane. Yeah. And it ain't like that.
How long have you been in this cell since you were brought back?
4 months.
How many other deportees in here with you?
One time it was 38 people in here.
You're joking. You could not have even sat down with 38
people.
One
time it was 38 people in here.
How did you sleep?
You know, pal by pal, people sleep on people like that.
What about food? Are they feeding you?
If you got family, I guess it's up to your family. If your family don't bring, then you don't eat.
You're not going to be in here forever. They can't do that because you know, you're not a criminal in this country.
Listen, I had somebody just call, you know, the dude named Mikhail. He was just saying that, or they forgot about us in here.
This dude, Mikhail, is Mikhail Lukius, the police chief in charge of vetting the deportees. And I want to ask him why these people are in prison in the first place.
La première raison, c'est que quand on reçoit des gens sur un territoire,
firstly, we need to check that they are indeed Haitian. And then we're dealing with people who have lived abroad for several years, and many have been exposed to hard crime. We can't just turn guys like these out on the streets. In the interest of public security, we have to keep them locked up for a while until we can find a way to reintegrate them into society.
Haiti has neither the money nor the infrastructures to integrate the deportees, and even Lukius can't say how long they'll have to remain behind bars. Commissaire Lukius isn't a bad man, and he's certainly nothing like the thugs who used to staff the Haitian police during the dictatorships of Papadoc and Baby Doc Duvalier. Lukius is a former political scientist and lawyer. Trained in policing by the Canadians, he's been in the job only 4 years. The corridor outside his office is frequently filled with parents pleading for their children's freedom. Some corrupt officials are trying to make money from this misery.
They had guys that come up here saying, I'll give them $50,000, they're going to get us out in 2 or 3 days. They got people that they stole money from. They got people that pay $5,000, $10,000, never get out. They're still in there. Never seen the guys again.
Travis Jolicoeur was released from the National Penitentiary in Port-au-Prince on the afternoon I interviewed him. Clearly, Travis had been traumatized by his experience in the National Penitentiary, and he was also terrified about his future in Haiti.
Now I got to face the fact that people in the street don't like deportees, all this. They just don't like people that come from the United States at all.
They resent you for having gone to the States in the first place.
Yeah, they resent you, you know, and they're jealous of us.
I'm Michelle Karshan. We have this program called Chance Alternative or Alternative Chance. We've had the program
few people care about the deportees, but one small NGO, Chance Alternative, run by an American, Michelle Karshan, is trying to educate them about their rights, help them get out of prison, and teach them the Creole language. But at the moment, with so many deportees arriving at once, Michelle's priority is delivering food and medical supplies to the jails and police stations. The project is funded by modest private donations, small change stuff, really. Michelle is well aware that many Haitians don't understand why she devotes so much time to criminals when the country has so many problems and so many innocent victims.
Yes, there are starving children in Haiti, and that's very tragic. But they're not in a cell with no options whatsoever. It's very hard for me to go to the jails and see people really starving. And then when you give a plate of food in to somebody, and somebody else says they're also starving, and why don't I know that? And they're literally gobbling as much as they can out of that plate. Okay, but we're not your lawyer, and we can't change the laws.
You're supposed to tell me. You come in for the criminal. I'm not criminal.
Okay.
It's cool, man.
Despite volatile tempers, Michelle says few of the deportees are dangerous criminals. Many of them, little more than teenagers, have been deported from the United States for what would otherwise be considered youthful indiscretions. But under the 1996 Anti-Terrorist Act, a response to the Oklahoma City bombing in which 168 Americans died, judges lost their discretionary powers on deportation cases. Expulsion became mandatory, no matter how plausible the mitigating circumstances. Michelle Karshan says the Anti-Terrorist Act is hypocritical.
The United States has continued to harbor all of these major terrorists, like Toto Constant, the head of FRAP, the paramilitary organization that terrorized the people of Haiti and was responsible for thousands of deaths and tortures during the coup d'etat. He can find harbor in the United States. He can lead a life, have a work permit, and go to nightclubs, even though he's wanted here on major, you know, terrorism. So how does it make sense? What message does it give? That you can be responsible for thousands and thousands of people dying in your massacres, but as an adolescent committing a nonviolent first-time offense, as many adolescents do, because it's part of American culture to have a troubled adolescence and to come through it with the support of your society and your family. It just seems like such an incredible contradiction that one has to wonder what the real motivation is.
Patients are certainly cynical about American motives here. I'm at an election rally for presidential candidate, presidential certainty in fact, Jean-Bertrand Aristide and his Lavalas party. One woman here is shouting, America should respect this little country. Aristide became Haiti's first democratically elected president in 1990. He was overthrown in a coup in 1991, and now he's running again for office. He isn't here himself today. The current situation is too dangerous for him to appear in public. But moving among us is René Seville, youth leader of Lavalas.
Ces députés-là, lorsqu'ils viennent en Haïti, ils cherchent à déstabiliser la société. Et ce sont des gens...
First, he said that we believe that those deportees represent a threat for the security in this country. We also believe it's part of a big plot to destabilize this country because they are sent here with nothing, no money, no way to survive, no reintegration program. So they can only be a problem for us.
I think that statement is preposterous. There are a number of individuals who are deported to countries throughout the world.
David Venturella of the Immigration and Naturalization Service in Washington isn't impressed by these conspiracy theories. So I asked him why these people had to be deported.
Well, Congress took a strong stance against individuals who committed crimes in the United States that applied to permanent residents and non-citizens. They sent a strong message that they will not tolerate this.
Are you aware of the conditions to which you're returning these people to Haiti?
I empathize that these people are going back to conditions that are less than what the standards were used to, but I enforce the immigration laws.
I saw a jail cell in which was about 10 feet by 10 feet, in which 38 deportees had been kept.
There wasn't even enough room. The Haitian government needs to address.
There wasn't even enough room, Mr. Venturella, for those people to lie down to sleep at night.
I can't really address that.
Meanwhile, Haitians go on suffering. Claudette Etienne fled the terrors of Baby Doc in the early 1980s, arriving in Florida in a leaky boat. Last year, she was charged with selling a small amount of cocaine. The authorities didn't think her offence deserved a custodial sentence. But earlier this year, she was unexpectedly hauled into the Chrome Immigration Detention Centre in Miami, and 7 months later, bundled onto a plane to Port-au-Prince. Michelle Carchan of Chan's Alternative is particularly angry that Claudette was deported when the judge didn't think she deserved a custodial sentence. Michelle reads to me from a letter Claudette sent to an immigration officer just a few months before her deportation.
She said, "Please reconsider my custody situation. I am still with my husband and we are still in love. The crimes I did were an argument with my husband and we forgave each other. The drug crime was because I needed the money for my children. I made some bad mistakes and I won't do them again. I'm sorry. Please reconsider my custody. I miss my children terribly."
And then what happened to her?
Well, Claudette was eventually deported and she was put in a police station in a small crowded cell with other criminal deportees and other prisoners. And she wasn't provided any food and after a couple of days she developed a serious dysentery. And on the fourth day they transferred her to the hospital where she died a couple of hours later.
Claudette is not, alas, the only person who's died because of the Anti-Terrorist Act, and it's tragic cases like Claudette's which have now spurred a number of US congressmen to push for a reform of the law. But Haiti's relations with the US are at an all-time low, and Washington is still coping with a basket case, of which it would dearly love to wash its hands.
That edition of Analysis was written and presented by Andy Kershaw. And don't forget that you can hear World Briefing on the internet. The address is www.bbc.co.uk/worldservice, and World Service is all one word. In a moment, we have a roundup of the latest world news, so do stay tuned. You're listening to the BBC in London.
For all the European news in the evenings, tune to Europe Today at 18 hours Central European Time, 17 hours GMT. We'll bring you the latest views and comment from Europe about Europe. And we're on the internet at bbc.co.uk/worldservice. Join me, Mark Reed, for Europe Today at 18 hours Central European Time.